All right, folks, welcome back into our special series on anti-fragility. Really excited about the conversation we are bringing you today. I had a chat with Jackie Space, somebody I'm a really huge fan of. Jackie's a wonderful person, tremendously accomplished, and a really incredible mother as well. Jackie served as a senior vice president for BMMT for about a decade. This is a national security-focused consultancy. She has spent years in the aerospace industry as a whole. She was kind of one of the founding faculty members or directors of Hacking for Defense, a course at Stanford that helped students kind of understand government problems. That has now expanded to be offered in over 100 universities and on multiple continents. She's got a military history in the Air Force, as I mentioned earlier, single mother to a lovely young woman as well, who's doing her own great things. And so Jackie's just an awesome person to talk to and sort of learn from. We dug deep into her sort of professional trajectory, some of the difficulties, the failures, the setbacks, and the learnings along the way. And then ultimately what all of that kind of means for the way she thinks about anti-fragility or seeking discomfort or navigating it, as well as how she's tried to help sort of open up those possibilities for her daughter as well. So Jackie's an amazing human. Had a great time chatting with her. Here it is. We hope you enjoy our conversation with Jackie Space. All right. So Jackie, let's start getting into your background a little bit. I think this will be fun because as I've just introduced you in your bio, I've always thought of you as one of my favorite types of humans, which is a badass human that doesn't think or doesn't know that they're badasses. And that's certainly, you exemplify that, but you do have a really incredible background. And I love it if you just start by just kind of walking us through a little bit of your professional history, because I think that's going to set the stage for a lot of what we'll talk about today in terms of anti-fragility.
Sure. Thanks. That's pretty nice coming from you. Yeah. I mean, I have a long background in national security. I started off after high school going to the Air Force Academy. And, you know, part of that drive for me was actually pretty selfish at the time. I needed free school. I wanted to get out of Texas. And I honestly don't think I had any idea of what I was getting myself into by going to the Air Force. I remember at the time telling my parents, like, oh, you know, don't worry about it. There's like, you know, the Persian Gulf War wasn't that bad. Like, you know, there's not gonna be any war. And then, you know, I graduated like right before 9/11 happened. And that was a real turning point for me, because I think at the academy, I kind of went through it with like not taking it too seriously, just sort of, you know, I felt like I needed the discipline coming from the background that I came from. I had a pretty chaotic growing up and like, you know, dysfunctional family and upbringing. And so I think the military really did appeal to me in a lot of ways, because I wanted some structure and I wanted some discipline. And it was really hard, but I didn't fully take it seriously until 9/11 happened. And for me, I was actually just stationed at Dover Air Force Base as a second lieutenant. And it was like 2 weeks, you know, brand new as an Air Force officer. And, you know, one of my first details was unloading the human remains from the Pentagon. And so, you know, that moment, I think, really changed a lot in terms of understanding that this career would probably a lot more serious or something that I took seriously than before. And in fact, then after that, I ended up being one of the first people deployed for the Iraq War. I was actually sent to a bear base with like 3 days notice to go get the logistics operation started to help us go into Iraq. And so I was there about a month before we declared war. And then I stayed for another 6 months, and it wasn't dangerous, but it was just very, you know, it was really hard. It was very chaotic. It was like US plus a bunch of coalition forces doing a lot of sorties in and out of Iraq from the UAE. And we were at a bear base, and yeah, things got kind of real at that point too, for me. It was just a whole different experience than what I had sort of trained for. But then I came back from that, and I was pretty jaded, honestly, like by that point. After, obviously, I had my own feelings about our reasons to go. And then after having spent time there and sort of seeing, you know, what a cultural quagmire we were getting ourselves into, I really came back pretty cynical and didn't want to be in the military at that point. And I just felt like it was going to be a massive disaster. And it, I mean, it was in a lot of ways. And not to take away from, you know, any of the servicemen and women that went, but I started feeling like, oh, I don't know if, like, I don't want to go back. I don't want to be part of this. Like, that was a really like challenging moment for me in my career. And so I came back to Dover, Delaware, and I basically asked the Air Force if I could switch out of my career field, because at that point I was in logistics and I wanted to do something different. And so they sent me to LA, where I got to do space acquisitions. And so I got to be part of the programs here, where they basically manage and oversee the development of space programs for the military. And that was really cool. I really, that kind of changed a lot for me, because I found something that I actually enjoyed. And so I think my first time seeing a rocket, I was really excited. I thought it was like really, really cool. And so I ended up going back for my master's degree in systems engineering, and then starting a career basically in the space national security side. And anyway, so I'm kind of rambling, but from that point on.
No, it's good. It's good. I think from there on is a whole trajectory unto itself. But before we move into that, let me, you know, because I'm obviously jotting down notes here, and it just, you mentioned asking to switch things up, right, with the Air Force, not feeling, sounds like, super positive or at least optimistic about what you were seeing and experiencing while in Iraq. But if I pick this up correctly, it was also, you know, some of those moments where you said it raised your level of kind of seriousness about the job itself, right? I kind of translated that as there was a lot of meaning and purpose and what you were, I think, hoping to do, or at some points in time doing, right? But it's often the case when we have that sense of purpose, but it's not being executed on or lived out in sort of the way that we might envision or a way that we feel good about, that actually creates a lot of discontent. It's like, I've got this nice dream and goal and idea of how I can have an impact over here, and then this like harsher reality over there. And the two often just, if they don't go hand in hand, it causes us problems. Is that a fairly accurate summary of your experience?
Yeah, that's very accurate. I don't think I understood it at that conscious level, sure. but I just knew that, I mean, there is a lot about the training that you go through in the military, and a lot about, you know, what you learn as far as like, you know, the history and you know, Uniform Code of Military Justice and like all these ideals around U.S. defense. And I struggled with some of that for sure, especially like in that case, right? Because it became pretty evident to me like pretty early on that this was going to be a long-term war, and that it was potentially going to be intractable. And, you know, then when you start losing friends and people that like at that point, it becomes it becomes really, really challenging to rectify like all the things that I believed in that training. And then, you know, being challenged with a values issue. And again, like, I am very patriotic, you know, I love my country, and there's no, you know, I'm very grateful to have been part of the military and to have gone through that. But there was that moment where I was like, I don't want to, especially after I had my daughter, I just had a child after that. I really didn't want to continue going back. And it's amazing, because when I was there, I realized too, there was like the amount of parents that were out there, because I wasn't a parent when I went, you know, I don't think I was 20 years old. I had my daughter when I was 26, but I just had no concept at that time, like, of how difficult that must have been for them, you know, to be separate from your children. And I mean, the service members, you know, that's their lived experience, you know, for a full career. Yeah, you really have to, I think in order to not get completely, you know, burnt out and jaded and cynical, you have to be pretty aligned, I think, with the values piece.
Well, and so it sounds like, you know, going back to this new trajectory, maybe that's where some of that alignment started coming in, right? So what I, again, just tracking what I'm hearing so far is purpose and meaning. I'm also hearing practice with chaos, both from childhood and from the military and obviously from war. I'm hearing general sort of unpleasantness from, like, incongruence, we'd call it, misalignment between values and sort of how you're living your life, right? So you carry all of that in, but then you get into the space field at large. Things, I think, take a significant change from there. So walk us through that a bit.
Sure. Yeah, that's an interesting way to frame it, but that's true. I mean, I started falling in love with the idea of putting things into space. I thought it was really cool. And I also, it was one of those things where I felt like, oh man, at that time I was like, man, I really missed out because I did the wrong major at the Air Force Academy. You know, I'm not able to get into this field this late because I, you know, I think at that point I was 26, 27. And I just felt like I'd missed the boat and I was pretty sad about it. But I was getting these jobs that were inside of the military that were like working inside of these programs. And I wasn't on the engineering side, but I was like on the logistics side, but I was still touching a lot of the engineering and the program management. And so I ended up deciding to leave the Air Force at that point because I knew that I would continue getting deployed and I would also be sent to other bases that weren't, you know, space related. Like, this was sort of an anomaly. It was like a career, like, oh, you have to go do this for a little bit of time and then you have to go back. And so I didn't want to do that. I wanted to stay and continue working on these programs. And so I got out of the Air Force, and then I still didn't really know what I was doing at that point. And I took some like really random odd jobs, and I was like, you know, I worked in Hollywood for a minute as like an executive assistant, and I was like a business broker. I did like all these sort of random things, but I realized like I didn't enjoy any of that, and I wanted to use my brain a little bit more. And so I went back to a contractor, an Air Force space contractor, and they hired me. And then they ended up paying for my master's in aerospace system engineering. And so at that point, I was basically, I think by that point, I had like a 3-year-old and I was working full time, going to grad school at night. And I really wanted to get my engineering chops under my belt because I wanted to be in the room, you know, in those programs, being able to have a seat at the table, basically.
Was that time in your life also chaotic?
Yeah. Yeah.
In a similar sort of way or a different sort of chaos?
I mean, I think anytime. Yeah, I was married at the time. And, you know, we just had my daughter. And so I think I look back on that now and I wonder how in the world I did that, honestly. When you have a young child, it's already so much work. I mean, it's so hard to describe to somebody who hasn't gone through it, but just the lack of sleep alone for me was really difficult the first couple of years, because like my daughter just didn't sleep. Like, she just refused sleep. and she's a great kid. She's 18 now. She's a great kid. But like at the time, like I think it's what kept me probably from having more children, is I barely survived her the first couple of years. And so then, yeah, so doing that, then plus, you know, like I said, working full time and going to school. And I think one of the things I realized about being in LA, because I grew up in Texas and then I lived in Colorado for school and I was in Delaware. And, you know, when I came to Los Angeles, I remember feeling like so depressed, when I looked around, because I just didn't understand how there were so many rich people. You know, like how do people live here? It's like, it was so, I mean, it was just, so, it was so far beyond my comprehension of like money, you know?
Small town, Texas. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in a suburb of Houston, you know, and we were like middle class, but like a starter home here where I was living was, you know, like $1 million. And to me, that was unbelievable. And I remember we were just like scraping by, you know, just like super scraping by. And it just felt like, you know, because we had, you know, done all these things in the military and then we came here, it was like, we were just starting over. And the pressure to work really, really was there. And even though I wanted to do something that I love, like there was no, I felt like there was just like, I just had to work, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Like staying home with my daughter. So yeah, that was a really tough time.
A lot of stress, a lot of pressure. Did you find yourself falling back on some of your Air Force experience in terms of like discipline, regimentation, systems, those sorts of things? Or was it just, you know, were you flying by the seat of your pants, or maybe a bit of both?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the military was good for someone like me because I tend to fly by the seat of my pants. You know, I'm not a naturally regimented, disciplined person. And so I sort of thrive under structure and deadlines, which I think like in those like engineering, you know, Air Force Space, like all those environments, that works fine. But you know, what I've learned later on is like where I fall apart is when I don't have that, you know, when I don't have the pressure of a deadline. So I can throw, I mean, that's where I sort of excelled. And I wish I could say, like looking back, that I had these like systems, but I really was just grinding.
Making it work. Okay. Making it
yeah.
work. Yeah. Yeah.
Like I remember one time I was at work during the day and I was doing schoolwork. Like in my cubicle, I was trying to get some schoolwork done for a class that night. And my like boss came in and sort of, you know, popped in and surprised me. You know, it was obvious I was not doing work. I was doing schoolwork. And she just, you know, let me have it. And I just started bawling, like, you know, which I never, like that for me, I don't think I've ever cried even when I was deployed or, you know, like at academy. That moment, I like actually sort of just broke down at work. And I think she didn't even know what to do with me. She was like, do you need a minute? And I was like, yeah. But it was just so like, I was just on the brink, you know, at that point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you then finish your master's, right? Where do things go from there?
Then I continued working for a bit, you know, at the base on those programs. I also ended up going through divorce around that time. And then I started to desire to want to not work for a large company. And so I was trying to figure out at that time, how can I have more flexibility? Because at that time I was, you know, at a top secret clearance where I was in what they call a SCIF all day, which is, I don't even know what SCIF stands for. It's a military acronym for special compartmentalized, I don't know what the IF actually stands for. I should know, but I don't know. But I worked at a SCIF all day, which meant that I had no access to like telephones. You can't bring material in and out. As a single mom at that point, it was really hard to like be separated from my daughter in that way. Like it really bothered me to not have access to my, I mean, or it was just such a pain to for just regular communication. And so I was really trying to figure out how could I strike out on my own in a way, like become an independent contractor, maybe work from home more so I could be with my daughter. And so then I started to, I think at that point I left my job and I had taken on some independent, like some contract jobs through the military. And that was a bit of a stretch for me because I was now working, like, I think one of my first jobs, well, I had several, but the one that really became significant was I ended up working at the Army's Rapid Equipping Force, which was basically the, like Skunk Works of the Army. So what they did was they would take like scientists and engineers and put them at the forward edge of the battlefield. And then they would sort of diagnose problems much more rapidly out there, prototype and get things fielded to basically save lives at that point. And so that was a really cool job. And I got to work from home. And basically I was managing their West, like $100 million of their West Coast portfolio of like all the companies that they wanted to potentially hire. And I was looking at it from a space angle, like how do we bring space to the battlefield? So back then, you know, that was commercial space. The idea of commercial space was really, really new. I think Skybox was one of the first companies that was actually a venture-backed space company that I was trying to work with to bring capability into the field. But regardless, it was kind of a really pivotal moment in history, because I think what was happening with the war, there's like sort of this inflection point that I think that's happened with the military, in that, you know, for the majority of the time that I've been in, and that, you know, people like in our recent history, the defense base has created all their own technology. And now with the proliferation of tech being made more rapidly on the commercial side, in a lot of cases, that has been a real challenge for the military to try to figure out, because, you know, we still have a $1 trillion budget, and then yet we're behind in a lot of the technology that we're developing. And I mean, you can see it now, you know, it's like on the Ukraine battlefield. And I mean, it's just become this huge, huge challenge. And so that became really evident to me that was becoming that would be a major problem. And especially like, you know, with Elon Musk and SpaceX, I remember I was in the rooms in the Air Force when the Air Force was trying to not allow him to compete, you know, against ULA. And I just, you know, I thought, oh my God, if there's this like South African that's like building rockets, I mean, every piece of technology that the government has ever developed is going to be now available commercially, internationally. I mean, it's a complete
big ripple effects. Yeah.
Yeah. Huge, massive culture effects that I think the military is really grappling with. And so that job in the Army sort of, you know, I think really woke me up to that. I was like I said, I was working from home, but the guy that was running the Army's Rapid Equipping Force, Pete Knoll, he decided to retire. And when he was driving sort of cross country, like to California, you know, I called him up and I was like, hey, you know, what are you doing next? And he's like, well, I'm going to go start this company in Silicon Valley, and we're going to continue the work that we were doing here at the Army's Rapid Equipping Force. And I was like, great, let me help. I want to help. And that's how we then started BM&T, which is the company that I co-founded, I guess, 10 years ago now. And that was, you know, I had no idea at that point in time, like how much of a tiger by its tail we were getting ourselves involved into. So a lot of ways it was great, because I got to sort of break out from, you know, I no longer had a 9-to-5 corporate job, and I could work from home, and I could be flexible, you know, now with being a single parent. And, you know, there was a lot of freedom in that. And I think, you know, what I didn't realize at that time, with everything, there's always like a trade-off, right? And in the case with the startup and with trying to build a company, it's incredibly consuming. It basically, you know, in many ways, it took over my life, because it's like we just hit the ground running. And, you know, from that moment, like it was a very frenetic pace. And I was on a plane a lot.
Did you love it at the start?
Yeah, it was awesome. It was really like, it was so fun. It was like terrifying at the time, because what we were trying to do is we wanted to basically help bridge the gap between, you know, new innovative technology and government programs. And we wanted to take what they were doing at the Army's Rapid Equipping Force and bring it across all the agencies, and some of the thinking and how they diagnose problems quicker, you know, get to the right problem before you start spending money on technology? Like, how do you rapidly iterate? How do you write better RFPs that make more sense and more in line with the technology environment? And so we really wanted to educate the government in that process. Yeah, it was awesome. But when we started, like, nobody was really talking about that. It was just a couple of us kind of banging around in Silicon Valley and Palo Alto. And then, gosh, like, you know, since then, I mean, it's the whole environment, at least in my industry, has like really exploded. So we were sort of there at the forefront of that. And it was a really, really cool time.
And that's about a decade ago, right? So you build up the company, right? You're doing all these sort of amazing projects, but included in that, I also want you to talk about, you know, kind of the development of your own curriculum.
So when we were in Palo Alto, we started trying to understand kind of like, how does Silicon Valley work, you know, and what makes it so special. And so we were there for about a year, you know, talking to various people. And my partner, Pete, and my other partner, Joe Felter, who was at Stanford at the time, they had run into a guy named Steve Blank, who basically is considered like the godfather of entrepreneurship. And he developed and wrote books around the lean startup theory, which he teaches at Stanford. So very synonymous with entrepreneurship and sort of a big deal in that community. He's a billionaire. He had 8 failures, then became rich and sort of, and then used that method to write about that and teach other entrepreneurs. And so he's responsible. I mean, he's done an amazing amount of work for entrepreneurship and other causes too. But he was teaching at Stanford and he saw what we were trying to do. And he also had an interest in national security. He's very patriotic. He was a veteran from the Vietnam War. And so, you know, he'd come to us, to my partners really, and said, why don't you take my curriculum from Lean Startup and the entrepreneurship course? And instead of trying to find product market fit, why don't you use it for government problems to find problem solution fit? And so it's kind of a wild idea, honestly. It's pretty wild at the time. And for me personally, I was kind of cynical around the idea because I didn't want to necessarily be in the classroom, and I wanted to be more on the tech side. And I think, you know, I was quite wrong in that case.
Hi friends, Nick here with just a brief interlude to share with you an update on one of our newest partnerships with the Anti-Fragile Academy. Throughout John and I's conversations with many, if not most, of our guests, one thing has been made really clear. In order for people to flourish, thrive, experience the good life, they need to develop the capacity to not only navigate and endure, but ideally grow from the bad, grow from unpleasant experiences. That's why we're thrilled to be partnering with our newest sponsor, the Anti-Fragile Academy, an organization that I co-founded with Dr. Adam Wright, Director of Mental Performance for the Washington Nationals. At the Anti-Fragile Academy, we work with adolescent athletes, executives, and educators to help them understand some of the science, not just of optimal performance, but of well-being and anti-fragility. The ability not only to endure and bounce back from unpleasantness, but to actually come back stronger, to grow from it. Between Adam and I, we've worked with Fortune 100 companies, Inc. 300 executives, Division I programs, and elite professional athletes and Olympians from all over the world. To find out more about how you can leverage anti-fragility training, check out our website at theantifragileacademy.com. If I may, I mean, you know, and obviously we've had these conversations before, but I'm hearing some, you know, I think, more details I haven't heard before. And like, the thought that just occurred to me is that feels like a full circle moment in some ways, because it seemed like the reason you wanted out of Iraq and out of the Air Force correct me if I'm wrong, was not only a lot of problems were occurring, but then I have to presume there was an inability to identify those problems and remedy them quickly. And I guess I'm just wondering if this maybe in retrospect gave you an outlet to kind of tackle some of those things that pushed you in this direction initially.
Yeah, I mean, right. I think I was being short-sighted at that point. Because I kind of saw it, like, in my mind, I was trying to build a company that would grow and survive. And so we had very...
It seemed like a distraction.
Yeah, we were taking the problem-centric approach of what we were doing. And we were running hard with that, with trying to get customers and trying to, like, work inside of programs. And so that's where my head was at. So the curriculum in the classroom, I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know about this. But I started sitting in on the entrepreneurship courses and Lean Launchpad. And honestly, it was amazing. You have these like incredibly smart Stanford kids who are just getting their asses handed to them, because it's the same thing that we see with which I'll get to with our course. But basically, these kids have this great idea that they want to bring, they want to go make a company around. They want to go, you know, bring it to market or develop the next new technology or whatever it is. And what's the beauty of the course, which is amazing, is that they have to present like the hypothesis of their product. And then they have to go out and interview 10 customers. And then they come back with that data. And they're using basically a framework, the business model canvas, to sort of invalidate their data, but it's all customer like driven. And the idea was that, you know, yeah, you have a great idea, but you know, your business plan is as good as soon as you get punched in the face, like the first time. I think there's some quote, I think it was Mike Tyson, but anyway, So I mean, these kids would just get hammered. And, but you know, at the end of the course, what they had to present was honestly amazing. You know, it wasn't just these half-baked ideas. They were like, you know, very, very driven in data and like good interviews and discovery. And I think that's something that, you know, that principle really did, and you know, change my outlook on how to like develop companies, how to develop new technology, how to, you know, it really like the idea around discovery, which is something that a lot of people don't want to do. You know, once you have an idea and you have a thing that you want to go do, you want to just go hit the ground running. But the element of discovery, I think, is what can be the difference between a successful venture or not. And so then, you know, with that idea, we decided to help put this course together called Hacking for Defense. And the idea was that we would take that same methodology and the students would present a like hypothesis around the solution to a government problem. But then they would have to go out every week and interview 10 people around the problem. You know, the interviews could be people inside the agency. It could be the agency's quote unquote customers, like who they're supposed to be delivering to on the operational side, on the acquisition side, you know, on the contract side, like all the people that have to touch, you know, a program, those students were out there interviewing. And so they would come back after. So for example, like, you know, there was an example of like, you know, a case where like these like Navy divers were getting lost underwater. So of course the students went right in with wanting to, you know, develop like this really cool, like wearable technology. And when they got in, and they were like all about it. And then when they got like halfway through the course, after talking to multiple divers, the divers were like, we won't fucking wear that because we don't want our like biometrics being reported back to, you know, doctors and anybody. Like they were so resistant to putting any sort of wearables on. And it became, you know, it was like a great idea, but then they ended up coming up with this other solution that I think ended up getting funding later, but where they were, you know, where they were able to sort of deploy these like sensors on the water, and it was like lightweight, totally different tack, you know? And what we ended up seeing over and over, well, the first course I think was really illuminating in the sense that, one, I didn't think that Stanford students would be that excited about government problems, especially because we had like, I think we had like the NSA in there, you know, there was the Air Force. I mean, they had, you know, I really thought it would be, they'd be pretty resistant to that. And I think what it showed was there was just a lot more understanding between the two worlds by the end of
it. I want to like just skip us ahead here just for a second, because I think it, you know, in some ways selling yourself short a little bit, but it ended up being, I think, quite interesting and quite popular. And I want to kind of put a bookend on some of the historical pieces here, but just tell the audience like where the course is at now.
Oh, well, that ended up going into like 100 universities. We have a program in the UK. It was federally funded. It is still a federally funded program. Yeah, it's now, I mean, there's been, you know, hundreds, I think thousands of students that have touched government problems, hundreds of programs that have been funded in some way, companies that have been started. It's been a really cool, so it was a really, really cool journey, you know, in that regard. And then behind that, my company then ended up growing quite a bit. We went from a small team to, I think at one point we were like 100 people in 4 different offices. And so it was quite the journey.
Yeah, it was quite the journey. Perfect. Right. And I could see the humility again, because you had trouble even looking at me when you were talking good about your course there, which is great. And just anyone watching instead of listening, I wish you could have seen it. But so I just want to like summarize here, though, and this is why I introduced you the way I did. So we went, right, left home, Air Force, war vet, mother, soon single mother, master's degree, space engineering, entrepreneur in Silicon Valley, built up this huge company, over 100 people, right? We leave the financials elsewhere, but suffice to say, highly successful. And oh, by the way, also helped develop a curriculum that's in 100 universities in multiple continents.
Yeah.
Yeah, quite the journey, I would say. Okay. And I wanted you to walk us through all of it, because I think it's really incredible. But it also, I think, teases out some of the things we're, I think, hearing from other guests. And so here's where I want us to like take a little turn and try to dig into, I think, what you've learned and pulled out of these experiences. And I want to start that by at least just planting some seeds here, because what I think I heard throughout this, you can correct any of this if it's wrong, a lot of unpleasantness. You mentioned chaos a bunch of times. You mentioned incongruence with values. I think I heard maybe some regret in there. I heard you actively, consciously taking on like really hard shit and challenges to like push yourself and grow, a lot of stress and pressure, especially, you know, when your daughter's born and you're thinking about working. And obviously, as that comes with being a single mom, I hear failure. I hear critical feedback. I hear uncertainty. And the reason I'm just pointing all of that out is, I guess what I want to ask is, do you feel like you have been successful and your life is, I think you would say, in a good place, despite all of that unpleasantness, or because of it? Maybe some of both, maybe somewhere in between.
That's a good question. I mean, I think the term successful is an interesting term. I mean, there's definitely various measures of how you're a successful human. I know the accolades and the achievements, but I think the experiences of failure and pain ended up making me a better person over time. There's a gym that I go to where they talk about failing better. It's called Gate 14. They're great. But yeah, I mean, I think there was like, it felt like for a long time, like I wasn't successful, you know, taking on some of that stuff. And I think that is my own neuroses that I've had, you know, that we've talked about. But as far as like when I look at myself now, like I just think I'm a better person than, you know, where I was 10 years ago, 15 years ago, just in terms of how I treat myself and how I treat other people and how I look at, like how I start looking at my goals now. It's just different than it was back then. I think in a lot of ways, for a long time, this starts getting personal. I mean, I didn't understand my own drive. I just knew I had it. And I just wanted to make it, you know, like I wanted to really escape my circumstances. And that was like really driving me for a long time, almost to an unhealthy, like it was unhealthy. It was unhealthy. I think there is a place where people can use work as like a an escape in a lot of ways. And so, you know, if I think about the balance in my life, like there was no balance. And I don't know that, I mean, I still, you know, I don't know that anyone can truly like have like real balance and like do really hard things. But I think there is a way to do it to where it's not just completely depleting yourself in the process.
So everything I mentioned earlier, right, that you, and I think you're saying you've grown from, whether you want to say those things led to you being a better person or those things helped you be successful, I think that's a both and, successful and a good person, right? And at the same time, so like we can sit here and talk about anti-fragility and acknowledge like, all right, there's some unpleasant stuff that seemed to like really help you and sharpen you and wield you. And at the same time, what you're bringing up here is there was a breaking point for you. And there is for everybody, by the way, right? We just happen to be starting to get into yours a little bit. So maybe you want to take us there.
Yeah, let's see, it was 2021 and, you know, we're in the throes of COVID, which I think, so prior to COVID, you know, I was on a plane between Palo Alto, DC and London, like all the time. And it was frenetic and just exhausting. And then COVID hits and, you know, being home and like all the uncertainty with that was like, was really challenging for me, honestly, because I was forced to sort of slow down. And then during that time, my father got diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, and it was pretty quick. I went home to basically take care of him until he passed, which was like 4 weeks after diagnosis. And I really thought like, oh, I'm fine. Like I felt like I was like, I'm doing remarkably well, like handling his death. And then like between that and I was going through kind of like a bad relationship, like a breakup, I kind of just lost it. Like it was like over a couple of periods of like months after my dad's death. And I just found myself in this position where I had no drive, like none whatsoever. I didn't care about almost anything. I was sleeping all the time, or I mean, I just had like, you know, all, like looking back on it, like I know I was probably like full-blown depression, I didn't understand it. And it was really terrifying for me and in that moment. And because I just didn't know what to do with that. And so that is when I decided, you know, and I'm so lucky. I was so fortunate in a lot of ways because, you know, at that time, my company had gotten to a certain level of success. You know, we weren't in the startup stages anymore that require, I mean, you know, my daughter was a bit older, you know, she was a teenager at this point. I mean, there was a lot of ways that I was able to sort of hide this. And I also knew at that time that I didn't want to take prescription drugs to try to get out of it. And I don't think it's bad for people to do that. I totally understand it. But for me at that point, I wanted to understand what was causing that and why and like how to fix it, like which ended up taking me in like a 3-year journey of my own sort of like self-discovery.
That's what I want to dig. Yeah, sorry to cut you off. That's exactly what I want to dig into. But just again, to kind of trace the trajectory here for everybody, like it seems like this constant sort of rungs of the ladder of difficult experiences, like one after the other, right? And maybe not elevating levels of difficulty, but all those different sort of examples from your past where, like, whether you knew why you were doing it or how you were doing it, you pushed through, you persevered, took on additional challenges, figured it out, navigated the chaos, all those sorts of things. And then you've got this kind of one moment, or at least an extensive moment, right, period of life where that's not happening, right? And you described it as potentially depression. You've used language like burnout with me, you know, in the past. And I just want to highlight that, because we're not talking about, I think, being impervious to anything life throws at us, right? But we are talking about mindsets, attitudes, skills that allow us to then navigate and ideally make the most of or grow from it, right? And that's why I think where you're about to take us on that journey of self-discovery. So I'd love if you just walk us through kind of what that's been like, some of the things that you've learned, and because I think you've had these very sort of, I did it, and there's this moment in life where I didn't do it, and all of it has taught you a lot about yourself.
Yeah. Honestly, I think that was probably the hardest thing I've ever been through in a lot of ways, because I think in my past, like whatever has happened in my life, I'm able to just figure it out. I just do it. I just figure it out, you know? And I think this was the first time where I was genuinely concerned that I would not be able to figure this out. And I just didn't know what it meant for me. And especially, I think when your identity is so wrapped up in your achievements, for me at that time, I mean, my gosh, I was like a startup founder of a successful company. And the idea of not being that was really scary for me. Like, what am I at that point if I'm not doing that? And so like that, it was, you know, it was hard. And so I decided, and it also kind of started, you know, I realized too, I had some bad habits, and that were like becoming, you know, without getting too much detail, but it was becoming a bit like dangerous, you know, for myself. So yeah, I had sort of like a wake up moment where I just knew I had to go get help. And I then ended up going to a 4-day like therapy retreat. I call it therapy camp at OnSite. And that really was sort of a turning point for me. But the journey after was so much longer and harder than I thought it would be, because I thought, like, I mean, just the first step for me to go to therapy was huge, because I had been through therapy before. It never stuck. I never was able to find a therapist that I liked, that I wanted to go to. I hated talking about my past. I never wanted to. I'm like, I don't want to talk about my childhood, you know, like I really, really just did not want to sit there and rehash events from my childhood. So, you know, I was very resistant, but I did it. And then, you know, I met my therapist there, who's now my therapist, Brendan, who in a very skillful, masterful way, like kind of led me on this journey for 4 days where, you know, I was able to like sort of see my own patterns for myself. Like, I didn't realize how severely codependent I was. You know, I had no idea. I didn't even know what that was, you know, but it made a lot of sense in the way that I grew up. I had a lot of addiction in the house, a lot of chaos and, you know, trauma. And so like, I just, you know, now I can have a lot, I have a lot more compassion towards it, but you know, getting myself to that point where I realized that was one of my issues was like, really, I mean, confronting. And so, you know, after, you know, and of course, then you can see the lens through which, you know, you can look at through all your failures in your past, like failed relationships, failed, really, I guess, around relationships, or, you know, even like friendships, work stuff. I mean, it started to make a lot more sense to me. And, you know, how I was, you know, what I was bringing to a situation. And but then, you know, after that, I thought, okay, well, now I know I'm good. Like, I can just, you know, I can just bounce. I can just go back. Right. And that's not how it went for me at all.
Can we just pause real quick? And then I want you to take us that next direction. But so far, and this is important, self-awareness, right? Increased dramatically through consistent therapy with somebody you've grown to like and trust. And I know you've spoken very highly of him. I just think this is critical because a lot of things we find or try to, I think, mention to people is like, there's not really a paint by numbers approach to well-being, to resilience, to flourishing, to thriving, to anti-fragility. It's just not the way it works. It has to be extremely personalized and very bespoke to kind of get the most out of it. And it sounds like you started by addressing that end, kind of, if you will, kind of this break-fix model first. And we're going to go into, you know, some of the other things I think you then did and learned and executed. But I think just a lot of our listeners will hear this and sometimes will think, well, I got to start adding the morning routine and I got to do the cold plunges and I got to have my gratitude journal and like they add, right? And it sounds like what you did was dig first and try to like understand and identify before just putting a bunch of junk on top of it, right?
Yeah, that's a really great point because I am certainly guilty of being like hyper obsessive around all the hacks, you know, like I mean, give me a good hack. I'm all like, if I can like hack my way out of something, like I, you know, and I really, really wish like that I could have just done. And at that point in time, if you would tell me, look, if you just cold plunge every day and like go do some breath work, you're going to be like 100% better. And I would have like, just, I mean, I was desperate for, I think I really understood that I had a systemic like problem. And what I didn't realize was, you know, if you would have told me before I went to onsite, before I went to my therapy camp, if you would have told me, yeah, this is going to be like a 3-year journey for you. It's going to take you out of work and it's going to be a whole thing. I don't think I would have done it. You know, and because it, like, the amount of work that I've had to do, like, to come back has been enormous. And what I didn't realize at that time was that, you know, if you look at codependency, think about it, it's like, oh, it's like an issue with like your relationships. You know, you sacrifice, you know, you don't really understand your own needs and you're like focused on other people. And then, you know, you get your validation through that, other sources. Totally. That makes sense. I mean, I can rationally look at that and say, I understand those behaviors. The problem that I didn't realize was that how that issue permeated in all aspects of my life. One thing I run into a lot with people that are in therapy is they're like, yeah, I went and did the therapy thing and I've like, I'm better now. Well, I kept thinking that like, I'm better now, but then, you know, a new situation would arise that was totally different. Whether it's a friendship, you know, a relationship, a parenting issue, like all these like things, right, that are in your life, like something new would crop up and it would be so easy for me to just sort of revert into these like unconscious patterns that took a long time of like having to just confront it every fucking time like go to therapy. So I mean, you know, I'm a huge proponent. Like before that, I was like, oh, I don't believe in therapy. And now I'm like, man, I think it saved my life, you know, a lot of ways.
So let's get to the heart of the matter then. I think you just took us there and we'll start to kind of wrap here a little bit as well. But a lot of our guests we've talked about, or I've asked directly, sort of like the one thing, you know, you might do to start whatever, feeling better, being more anti-fragile, like it's the habits and it's the hacks and it's the systems and it's the things like that. But I guess I would frame your question a little differently, which is, how did you finally get to a point? And I think you're going to tell me it's an active process, not that you're all of a sudden just done, I figured it out. But how did you get to the point where you felt like you could break some of those either conscious or unconscious sort of habits and loops and routines and ways of being and shift out to this kind of newer person that eventually pulled you out of that burnout and pulled you out of some of those experiences? What ultimately changed?
It was little by little changes. You and I have worked a lot on the cognitive behavioral therapy side and like the reframing of perspectives and how to question your story around something. And that is a hard thing to do in practice, but it does require practice. It requires a lot of practice. And it was one of those things where it's like, what I realized over time, and I can't say there was like one moment where I'm like, oh, I'm better. But it was like one of these things where I just like woke up one day and I was like, oh my gosh, I have a lot more peace in my life. I think before there was just a lot more chaos that I just kind of knew how to thrive in.
Maybe not thriving, by the way.
You're right. Right.
In retrospect, navigating. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Navigating. Yeah. That I was just sort of used to. And now, you know, with learning about, especially understanding boundaries, like really understanding what boundaries mean. It's not about the other person. It's about you, you know, and how your choice to react to something and what you allow into your life, like all of that. Yeah. One day, it's been recent, pretty recent, where I'm like, wow, like all of my relationships are really nurturing and compassionate and mutual, like, you know, it's like a
reciprocal.
Yeah. I've got really good people around me. I've met amazing people along the way, like yourself and Adam. but just the process that I've been through, like, I got to take a course with Scott Barry Kaufman on self.
Shout out SBK. Yep. We love SBK. Yeah.
I mean, it was fantastic. And I just did all, I was just doing all these things to try to help myself, but you know, I don't think any one of them was like the thing. It was like, sort of like, it just overall, like it just very gradually, then like 3 years later, here I am. And I feel like I'm like a functional adult again, that actually can go back to work, that can have healthy relationships, that can take care of herself. Yeah. It's a much more integrated way of being.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way of describing it. It certainly sounds like a lot of it starts, as it often does, with like mindset and perspective. You mentioned the story you told yourself, kind of reframing some things, even having basic levels of optimism enough to take the class, to talk to the therapist, to learn this, to read that, to try that hack. Like all of that comes fundamentally from a mindset.
I mean, some of it is you have to fake it in a lot of ways. Like I know in my codependent stuff that a big function of that is like low self-worth. And that is, you know, if you don't know that you're that way, or you don't know that you have that, like it's just the lens through which you see the world, you know, and it affects kind of everything. And so that like cleaning of the lens and sort of removing these like layers that were, you know, that just don't make sense anymore, that process has been a really beautiful, like, I can say that now. I mean, it was really fucking hard, you know, for a long time. Like very confusing. I honestly didn't know like where I was going to end up with this. Like it just felt like I was just like staring off into space, you know, like with just no plan other than to try to feel better. But I think now, you know, I can see it. It really is an integrated way of being. And it does start with like the mindset and the perspective and like how you respond to events. Cause you know, you always have a choice, right? Before it felt like it was very like unconscious in the way that I was like responding to things. And now there's a lot, you know, I have a new meditation practice that has now been consistent for a year, and spiritual side of it. And like, that has really helped me to also like in this process.
Increased awareness. Yeah. Yeah. Awareness, perspective, mindset. Yeah. Yeah. Good. We've got to wrap here, but I am curious, you know, we typically ask a question or two just about parenting. And obviously you've got, you know, a lovely child that is now, I think, in the first year at an esteemed institution that you're super proud of. But aside from gloating about her, how has your experience, if at all, and I have to imagine it has on some level, influenced the way you have parented, some of these lessons that you've learned?
Yeah, I was very concerned that, because my daughter was like number two in her class, like she was just all around awesome at school, but I was really concerned that my hyper productivity would sort of rub off on her. and being like very achievement oriented as like a source of self-worth. And so we both were in therapy, you know, for several years. And thank God. I mean, she seems to be like so well adjusted. She's got lots of a great social network. You know, she's at UCLA, so she's around the corner. She seems to be just like really thriving and confident, you know, in herself. And especially because like when she was 12, she came out as being gay. And, you know, I think not that that, I mean, it's just an additional sort of dynamic as a parent, like, you know, raising a gay teen, that like you, like the biggest fear is that like they're going to feel like they're less than for some reason, you know, or that, and I can honestly say like, I'm so amazed at her, just at her self-concept, like how, like she seems really wise for like an 18-year-old, and it probably has a lot to do with, you know, just all the stuff that I put her through too. You know, I mean, she dealt with single parent, like being gone a lot. It was a lot for her.
Hard stuff too. Which is kind of, you know, why we're always asking is, I think, not a parent myself, spent a lot of years in a lot of schools and a lot of teams around a lot of families. And there's like one thing is pretty consistent across the board, which is like most parents want their kids to be happy. But I often find, and I think parents will mention it too, sometimes that like you lose the forest for the trees and you just like have constant pleasantness for them.
Yeah.
Right. And so part of the themes we've been pulling out in these conversations is like the extent to which a parent might intentionally put their kids into hard things and help them learn to navigate certain difficulties and be more self-aware and talk about those sorts of things. And maybe there is some of that with you, but I think what I've heard from your answer that we didn't necessarily hear from others is it sounds like you had a really conscious focus on helping her develop an integrated sense of self, to use that word we used earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a tendency, I saw a lot here in my town, like around helicopter parenting.
Sure.
And I was like,
we both spent a lot of time in that Southern California scene, and it's a huge thing.
Yeah. It's a huge thing. And I was kind of the opposite of that. And she really, I think, did it herself, not herself. I mean, obviously she had a lot of help, but like, I wasn't talking to teachers, you know, I wasn't like in there arguing for grades, and
room to struggle.
Yeah. Yeah.
And room to flounder a little bit.
It was really important. And I mean, like, you know, in my case, like with my father, like he was extremely harsh, but with her, I don't think there was ever a time that like I truly yelled at her or like, you know, was like angry at her for like a choice in school. I mean, she really, I think deep down, you know, like this was her, like she wanted to go to UCLA. She, you know, she has all these like goals and dreams for herself. And just recently she came to me and she said that she's interested in the music industry and she's like writing and producing music and like, and I think some parents, like my dad would have flipped out if I came home and said that, you know, and I'm not trying to disparage my father, but like I'm like just happy, you know, I'm like, yeah, like go do whatever, you know, it's your life and we have a great relationship. So I'm, you know, I'm just really, really happy, really proud of her.
Yeah. Great. Awesome. Well, we got to wrap, but Jackie, thanks for spending the time with us. I know you're busy and you got a lot of things going, and we appreciate you sharing your story and your insight.
Oh, thanks, Nick. It's been so awesome working with you. Really. Like I've learned so much. So thank you for everything.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah. Well, this has been fun hanging out, and hope the audience enjoys.
Thanks so much for listening to Flourish FM. We hope you enjoyed the content. Please be sure to leave us a 5-star review and hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to your podcast and on all major social media platforms.
And if you visit our website, flourishfmpodcast.com, you can sign up to our newsletter. We send out a weekly newsletter. First newsletter of every month, we share a long form blog. And every newsletter, every week, we share highlights from our previous episodes. Please hit subscribe on our website.